Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for September 3rd, 2007, and on this episode we have director Lou Conti. He will be talking to Tom Williams about his latest show, Paradise Lost by Clifford Odets, now playing at the Timeline Theater. Also on this episode, we have Chicago's theater news, so get ready, Chicago. Let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I am at Timeline Theater with one of the top directors in Chicago, a man who has, to my count, 7 Jeff Awards, one of the terrific directors in town, Lou Conti, who is directing a terrific production of Paradise Lost. Hello, Lou.
Hello, Tom.
Tell us about Paradise Lost for those people who are not familiar with the play or with Clifford Odets.
It's one of the plays that Odets wrote in the mid-30s with the group theater, along with Awake and Sing and Waiting for Lefty, among others, that gives voice to the impoverished, those who don't have a voice, those who had a voice and lost it in this particular case in the world, and try to find a way to change the world.
So he was, give us a little background on Odets. He was a socialist who was into using theater as a way to do social change.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I would assume he's been labeled by so many different people in so many different ways, whether he was a pure socialist or not. His writing is certainly socialistic. I prefer not to put a label on him, but he was writing with the group theater, who was kind of the parent company for him for a very long time. He started out as a stage manager and played a lot of bit parts and small roles, and started writing for them. No one wanted to read his plays in the beginning, but eventually,
right?
Yeah, he wrote a version of Awake and Sing called I Got the Blues, and he read it to the group theater, and most of them just didn't like the play. They didn't think it was very good, and Lee Strasberg, in fact, told him, "We don't want to do your plays. We don't think you're very good," and that kind of wounded him a little bit. But Harold Clurman took him under his wing and kind of encouraged him. The two of them were close friends, and they talked quite a bit about the world and the theater and how the world can be changed. They walk the streets of New York City during the Depression. Clurman describes it very vividly in his book, The Fervent Years. And little by little, Odets began to, you know, figure out where his voice was and how to make it work, and through various plays like Awake and Sing and Paradise Lost with a group theater, he managed to find his voice and bring that to the American theater.
So, well, tell us about Paradise Lost, and then we'll get into Awake and Sing, which you also directed, which was one of the terrific productions of the last few years. But Paradise Lost is about the Gordon family.
The Gordon family is not an incredibly wealthy family, but a well-to-do family. The father works in a firm, owns a firm, or is a co-partner in a firm that creates women's handbags. And he's done very well for himself. His son, his oldest son, Ben, is an Olympic runner. He's won a medal in the Olympics in the 30s. I guess 1932 would be the Olympics. It's not based in fact, but it's what Odets has kind of created for us. And his daughter, Pearl, is a concert pianist of great talent, but is unable for one reason or another to find work in the industry. And his youngest son, Julie, is unrealized in terms of his potential. He's about 17 years old, but he's dying of what they then called sleeping sickness, which was a kind of a viral infection that literally ate you away from the inside out. And Leo's wife, Clara, who is more or less the pants in the family, and holds the universe for the two of them together, and their extended family, Gus Michaels. It's not specified how he and Leo know each other, but that they've known each other for a very, very long time, and they are very close. And Gus's daughter, Libby, is marrying, or has just married by the time the play begins, the oldest son, Ben. And Libby is a little bit of she's a little bit of a gold digger and not on good terms with her father.
Okay, that. So this isn't what you would think would be a socialist place. So it's not a poor family in the struggle. It's kind of a collapsing middle class family where the depression is taking its toll.
And I think that, you know, Odets wanted to show the opposite end of the spectrum from Awake and Sing, which is a family, you know, about a family that is at the other end of the financial, you know, stratum. The Gordon family had some success. They had paradise, as one of the characters later on in the play says, and now that after the crash they've mismanaged their finances and kind of misread the whole, you know, temper of the country, they find themselves in a place where they are going to lose everything that they've created up to this point.
But one of the things I really liked about was the character of Leo. I mean, Leo is the kind of the personification of the nobility of man. I mean, no matter what, he gives the raise to the people because he has a social conscience, even though he's a businessman. And then there's some scenes without giving away where he could have gotten a lot of cash money that was questionable. But he stood above that.
He's a man of integrity. That's the most important thing to know about Leo. And he's a bit of a philosopher, and he believes in, you know, the righteous cause of mankind and people helping people and, you know, people not being exploited by the masses, not being exploited by the politicians. There's a scene in the play where a politician comes in and tries to garner some votes, and Leo pretty much reads him off.
Yeah, it kind of throws him out of the house, yeah. Well, what got you to this play? And by the way, I must congratulate you on the casting. We'll go into that in a couple of minutes because I know the group theater wrote these plays to be ensemble pieces. And I know Timeline Theater likes to do historical ensemble pieces, but this is a cast of 14 terrific players.
It is a large cast. In fact, there's 20 characters in the play, and we've done a little bit of condensing in order to, you know, facilitate the number of bodies that are actually in the dressing room area. PJ Powers and I talked about a year or so ago, you know, about different plays that we wanted to do for this season, with the idea in mind that the theme, if there was one for the season, might be, you know, one man standing alone trying to make a difference. And we had read this play back when we were considering Awake and Sing. We read most of Odets's plays, either separately or collectively, I can't remember. But we read most of his plays, and we settled on Awake and Sing 6 years ago because we felt that was the right choice for that season. But we came back to this one because we like the texture of the fabric of the play. We like the characters. We like the universe of the play. And I felt that there were a lot of contemporary resonances in it.
Oh, I did too. I said that in my review, yeah.
I feel like...
You could update this to references to 07 and be right on.
You could, and I think there are a lot of things that when people see the play that they will sit back and kind of go, well, that's not far from what's happening right now in the universe. But those were the kind of things that drew us to the play, and the play has, you know, a lot of challenges in terms of casting, as you said. They're, you know, complicated characters, and a lot of them. It's an ensemble play where, you know, most of the time there's five or six characters on stage. And Odets is very good at holding a lot of arguments in his head all at one time and letting the audience kind of experience it from all different points of view.
Yeah, and he doesn't miss a line. I mean, those writers in the 30s, not only him, Eugene O'Neill and Miller and a lot of the others, if you came on, your character came on and had five lines and a persona, you made an impact on the play. So he did, there was no throwaway characters or throwaway words in these plays.
Not to make comparisons, but he's very much like Chekhov in that respect. The characters have a purpose, even the smaller ones, and they have a point of view. And Odets is very good about allowing each character have his or her own point of view, and allowing them to feed into the fabric of the play. And in this play, because of the cast size, there's quite a lot of it. The language is very very rich and lush, and Odets was heavily influenced by vaudeville and by Hollywood movies at the time. So a lot of the language of the play reflects the kind of dialogue and the kind of language that he was hearing around him as he was navigating the universe of New York City in the 30s.
So a lot of it he did get from plays. Also, I think it helped. He could write tough street language without the dirty, foul language that we hear in today's plays. And call me old-fashioned, but to me that has more effect.
Yeah, and I think it's more poetic in the long run. I think it's more poetic, and I think the characters, they paint a different picture with it without using profanity. I don't think it's necessary, really, to do that. You know, it's a different universe. It's a different world, too, in the 30s, and not that they didn't have profanity in the 30s, but it doesn't have the same impact now that it did then. And I think the language of the play kind of expresses a sense of hope. And I think if you use a lot of profanity, you kind of take that away from the play.
Yeah, and you take away some of the dignity of the characters because you empathize with all of them. And, I mean, there's so many little subplots and stories going on here. There's the cab driver character who will do anything to get ahead. And he lulls in the kid that wins the awards. I'm blanking on his name.
Ben.
Ben.
Yeah.
And so you have all these subplots, but let's get into casting. Give us some of the decisions on some of the casting, because I think it was superlative.
Well, we had a lot of challenges trying to make this play work. You know, in any non-equity theater, it's difficult to find mature actors of any quality. You know, they're out there, but they're spread pretty thin with the amount of work there is. And casting during the summer is also a little bit complicated, and we found our challenges with that as well. But I listened for and I looked for people I felt could click into the language of the play and the universe of the play. There were some people you could tell just weren't living in Odette's world, and it takes a trained eye to kind of pick that out and a trained ear.
Well, and you dip back into your bag of people who have done Odette's for you before.
I did. I wanted to make sure that the play was fresh. I wanted to make sure that the production wasn't a repeat of Awake and Sing. But when, at the end of the day, when I had to make certain choices, I decided that, people who know this language and who are very good at it, need to be here to give voice to it.
And you're casting for Leo Gordon, Michael Kingston. Brilliant. Brilliant decision. Yeah, he's... I've always liked him, and I thought he anchors the show.
He's a smart, sensitive man, and he weighs his words and he weighs his thoughts, and he really carved out Leo out of a very, very massive chunk of stone, and it's an achievement.
Yes, and for Clara, tell us how you cast Janet Ulrich Brooks, who's again one of our great leading ladies.
Janet was actually the first person cast, and we cast her as soon as we made the choice to do the play. I had just worked with her in the one-woman show Lillian, about Lillian Hellman.
Yes, that was brilliant. Oh, that was brilliant, yes.
And she was fantastic. I've seen her work before, and we've known each other in passing. We didn't have the opportunity to work together until last season, but we knew immediately when we made this decision to do this play that this was the actress to play Clara. We knew she could ground the play, and we more or less built the play around her. Once we started to make other decisions, in casting,
yeah, especially early, she sets quite a bit of the tone.
She does. She does set the tone for the universe of the play. She sets the tone for the family and for Odette's message, which is about trying to not let life be printed on dollar bills, as they say in Awake and Sing, trying to make life something richer and more interesting. Leo gives a little bit more voice to that particular philosophy.
Yeah, particularly later when he has the soliloquies.
But you feel grounded in Clara's character because she's solid and the family is built around her, and Leo is the dreamer and Clara is the solid base.
Well, and for those who saw Awake and Sing, Odette's was worried about having this play being like Awake and Sing 2, sort of.
Yeah.
So these the Gordons aren't, they're not a Jewish family. They're Christian or whatever. I mean, the name.
It's a little nonspecific, but Odetz did go back through the play after an early draft and remove anything that he felt made the play too Jewish or too ethnic, because he didn't want to repeat what he did with Awake and Sing.
He wanted a wider universe.
I guess he wanted a broader appeal to it. And side by side, the two plays do have a lot of similarities. And, it's one of the reasons why we didn't necessarily decide to choose this play for the following season after Awake and Sing. We felt, we need some perspective. You need some distance for this. And we figured we would wait it out. But it had a lot greater resonance for me when I read it last summer, deciding to do it. Because I could see it then above the fog of Awake and Sing. You know, when you see Awake and Sing, when you read that play, it's his masterpiece. It's the play that I think cries the loudest or sings the loudest.
Yes, I agree.
And Paradise Lost sometimes, pales in comparison to that. But when you allow it to speak on its own and for its own self, it has its own values. It has its own textures. It has its own message. And I think that comes through. I think that comes clear.
Yes, it does. All right, let's go on with the casting. You cast one of my favorite character actors, Scott Aiello. I mean, he can do anything. He's very talented.
He's a chameleon.
Yes, he is.
He's a chameleon. And, he comes through again. I've cast him a number of different times, not only here at Timeline, but elsewhere. He's very vivid, and he's not afraid to walk on the edge and sometimes jump off the edge.
Yes.
He's a smart guy, and he loves what he does, and his passion is very apparent, and it comes through in the work, and that's something you have to have when you do Odetz. The passion has to really erupt in the play and erupt in the language.
Especially when he's the radical.
He is. He's the guy with the most to say about the most things, and Scott's a guy who's got a lot to say about a lot of things.
Yeah, well, that was... And tell us about some of the younger players. You have Jeremy Glickstein and this Aaron Golden. That's the first time I've seen him.
This is his debut in Chicago. He just graduated, and he's I think it's from Northern Illinois University. I'm not sure, but I think that's what it is. And this is his first professional production in Chicago. And he was seen in an audition by PJ earlier in the spring, and PJ recommended him to me. We watched him. We looked at him. We called him back a couple of times. His work was great. He really embodied what I was looking for in the character of Ben. He had the youth and the vitality, but he also had, the fire in the belly, as we like
to
call
it. Oh, yeah. He did that well. It's a terrific find. And it's a good opportunity. I'm sure he's learning a lot working for you.
Getting his baptism of fire in this play.
Well, welcome to Chicago. And any of other... Some of the other veterans. I like the other young, this Jurgen Hooper. He's been in a lot of things at Steppenwolf and Goodman.
He's done some work. I confess that I have not seen most of it, but
he was in Huck Finn. He did a terrific job in the one they do for the high school kids.
And I've heard great things about him. And we saw him last summer when we were casting our production of General from America. He was unavailable to us. We saw him in an initial audition, but he was unavailable to us because of commitments that he'd made at Writers Theater up in Glencoe. So we decided to give him another look-see when we came around to this play. And I knew immediately, when he read for it that he had the stuff for the part. And trying to balance out whenever you're casting a family, it's really difficult to balance out everybody, not only in terms of talent and skill, but in terms of how they affect the dynamic of the family.
He's perfect for the sickly kid who's really smart,
right,
and quite vulnerable.
Right.
He plays that vulnerable very well.
He's very good at it.
Yes. Well, then you have people like Michelle Moe, who's one of the top ladies in Chicago.
My first time working with Michelle, and I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity. She's a terrific actress. I've seen her work before, and she's somebody I would love to work with again.
And tell us about some of the other Brian McCarthy and Whit Spurgeon.
Whit Spurgeon, who plays Gus Michaels. Whit was in Awake and Sing. He played Myron Berger, the father. Witt is, he's a character actor. There's no two ways about it.
And one of the best. I think he, in some ways, he steals the show, certain scenes.
In some places, yes, he does. He's a veteran of Chicago theater. He's a member of the Prop Theater, where he has recently and will, in the near future, be in His Honor, which is a long-running show for them.
Sure.
He's going to be going back into that at some point. Witt's a guy with a lot of talent and skill, and he's just a lot of fun to work with. And he brings a lot of vulnerability to the character, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted him in the part.
Yeah, and he has some of those long speeches where it's kind of the voice of the hopelessness part of what was going on in the Depression. He's the voice of all that.
Yeah, he really does give a lot of empathy to people out there in the world, in the Odette's world, who don't have and or don't understand why they don't have.
Yeah, and he's kind of... His character's universal in the sense, too, that so many people are living in the past. You know, they don't realize life keeps going, and they're not that old, but they're living in a world that they don't realize has been gone for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, and especially at that point in time, it's a pivotal moment in American history. It's a pivotal moment in world history, and people tend to cling to nostalgia when they feel threatened. And in that universe, in Odette's world, people felt very threatened by things past and things that were coming in the future, and they cling to the things that they knew in their youth. And Gus Michael's character definitely does that.
So tell us, you haven't indirectly, but why you like doing Odette's so much? Because you've done several Odette's plays, and I know you know a lot about him. I agree. I think his work needs to be done.
You know, that's a tough question.
Okay.
And people ask me all the time, and this is the fourth Odette's play that I've directed.
Which other ones besides Awake and Sing?
I've done The Country Girl, which I did when I was in graduate school. I did Rocket to the Moon at Shattered Globe.
That's right. That was brilliant.
So,
yes.
This is the fourth one. I don't know. I hear his voice in my head, and I hear the lines, I hear the language, and it makes sense to me. Sometimes you hear a play, and you just can't wrap your mind around it. You just can't wrap your lips around the words. But with Odette's, I just find that I understand what he's saying. I hear his language. I grew up on the East Coast and in an Italian-American family, and you know, the ethnic culture is very, you know, very prominent there. And I hear the voice that I heard in my youth, in my childhood.
Okay.
And it's comforting. I guess that's the best way to put it. It's comforting to hear it.
Time for a little commercial for the show. It's Paradise Lost. It's at Timeline Theater. You guys run, what, Thursday, Friday, Saturday? I think, don't you do a Saturday matinee, too?
We do a 4 o'clock on Saturday, okay, and a 2 o'clock on Sunday.
Sunday, and then your Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in the evenings, too.
Right, and I think we're going to be doing some Wednesdays in the calendar as well. I'm not
okay.
sure exactly which days
of okay,
are.
You can go to the Timeline website, will tell you that. So tell us now about your background, because you've been a busy director over the years here in Chicago. You did say you're from the East Coast. So tell us your background so we can...
Born and raised in New Jersey, northern New Jersey. I grew up 10 miles from New York City. Came from a, like I said, an Italian-American family. We're third generation. My grandfather was born in the house I grew up in, so we're pretty deeply rooted. I had three brothers. My parents were both school teachers. My father was a history teacher, and I grew up reading history books. He had piles and piles of them, and most of them were early 20th century, World War II history. So I think that's where my affinity for history and for the kinds of works that we do at Timeline comes from.
Okay.
And I got my bachelor's degree in acting and directing from Montclair State College, which is now Montclair State University in northern New Jersey. And I got my master's degree here in Chicago at DePaul University's Theater School.
Okay, and what got you to leave New Jersey for Chicago?
This is a long story. Try and make it as concise as I can. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to see some of Steppenwolf's work in New York City, specifically their very, very fine and rich production of Balm and Gilead.
Oh, yeah.
It was a life-changing experience.
For many of us.
For many, yeah, for a lot of reasons. it opened my eyes to the possibilities. It was things that I had not seen and not even contemplated in terms of the craft. And I had the good fortune to meet with several Steppenwolf actors at the time and thought, you know, there's something going on in Chicago. Maybe I should check it out. I applied to a variety of graduate schools, but DePaul, you know, was the most attractive one because I thought Chicago seems to be a place I can grow and I can learn the craft. So that's what brought me here, and I've been here 21 years.
So you came for a visit and stayed 21 years.
Something like that.
It's amazing how many people gravitate to Chicago as a theater center.
Yeah.
I think New York may have us in the big Broadway musicals, but on any other level of theater, I think Chicago is where it's happening.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here, and there are a lot of opportunities, and it's a great place to learn your craft. And for audiences, it's a great place to see, you know, a lot of quality theater. You can go on any day of the week pretty much and see really great quality theater in a lot of different neighborhoods.
That's true, yeah. So so you finished at DePaul and you started directing. Were you ever on stage as an actor?
I did two very brief stints on stage in Chicago, both of them with Shattered Globe Theater. I just found that it was not as rewarding as it had been when I was in college. And once I discovered the virtues of directing, I realized that that's where my real skills lay and where my voice lay. It allowed me the opportunity to, you know, start really having a say about things. And what I mean is that I could start to choose work that I thought was important, choose work that I think has a voice and that sort of thing. And acting didn't always give me that opportunity. And then there were a lot of other, you know, idiosyncrasies about the craft of acting and the profession that weren't as attractive to me after I'd had a little taste of directing.
Well, I remember your judgment at Nuremberg and at Shattered Globe. You've got to be proud of that.
Very proud. Very proud of it.
I remember, wasn't the playwright was there who did the film?
Abby Mann.
Abby Mann, right. And I'm blanking on his name. And in the lobby, I don't know if you know this, in the lobby after opening night of it, he said out loud, kind of to me, but and in a group, there was like several of us, that your production was better than the film and that Maury Cooper was better as the Nazi judge who gets up and gives the big speech at the end. And I thought that was amazing. I don't know if you heard that. Did he ever tell you that?
He did say something to that effect to me in private, and he said it rather publicly to many people.
Yes, he
on
did.
That particular day, and he was very generous with his praise, and I greatly appreciate, you know, the opportunity to meet him and to hear from him about it.
Well, what was so terrific about that was, you know, the point of view that you took. Because in the film, which I thought the film was good, you know, they did so much with close-ups and zooms and edits and so forth, but you had to create that power and the tension of that show on a relatively intimate stage.
Yeah, it's the Victory Garden Studio is, if not intimate. You do what you can with what you have to work with, and in that space, you know, intimacy is the thing you have to start with, and the play is, you know, a very public play. Much of it takes place in a courtroom, in a very public and very famous courtroom. The real challenge to it was to try and make it seem personal, make it seem important to every person in the audience. And again, I think there's a testament to the great writing of the piece itself. Abby Mann did the adaptation of it, and to Maury Cooper's performance.
Wasn't it amazing?
As Ernst Janning, he was amazing and incredible, and I can't even begin to come up with enough adjectives to really define it, which helped to really, you know, make it that you know, kind of personal. And it's a relatively small part in the play.
Yes,
it is not a huge role.
He doesn't get up till near the end. Yeah,
he doesn't actually speak until almost halfway through the first act, and he doesn't really voice his point of view until almost three quarters of the way through the play. So it's a testimony to Maury's power as an actor, too, I think.
Yeah, and well, what you do with the pacing of that show. I saw it a couple of times. You remounted it downtown for a while.
Yeah.
And each time I did, I brought someone else there who was tremendously affected by it. And it's incredible. After knowing exactly what's going to happen, seeing the same cast, it still just grabbed me in the key scenes.
Yeah, and it's whenever you remount a play where after any amount of time has passed, it's sometimes a little bit difficult, but it's surprising how the muscle memory and the emotional memory comes right back to the actors, and with minor adjustments, you know, it's relatively simple to bring it back.
I think you're being modest here, because I think Paradise Lost, Awake and Sing, Judgment and Error, among the other, I mean, I can go on and on naming you. I think you're one of the best directors in town at casting, finding the exact right person for the right role, and then getting them on the same page.
It's a skill.
Well, tell us how you approached it, because, I mean, these aren't kids out of college. These are veteran actors who know their craft. And, you know, and I know a lot of directors have told me sometimes directing is managing egos as much as anything.
Yeah, it is sometimes. But, you know, I do like to use actors that I've worked with and in some cases repeatedly worked with, partly because I know their process. But in casting any play, regardless of the needs of it, you want to find people who are going to be professionals, and you want to find people who are going to bring the most to the part and to the play. And then you let people do what they do best.
Okay, that's the key for you?
That is the key, because, and I was told a very long time ago, you know, when you're having problems with a play or, you know, when things don't seem to be working, it's probably because you didn't put somebody in a position to succeed. You didn't find the right person to do the right job. And directors take responsibility, or should take responsibility, for every aspect of the production. And for me, that's, you know, I have to find the right person for every aspect of production, whether it's the performance, you know, the actor, or whether it's the lighting designer or the costume designer or the sound designer. You know, you put people in a position to succeed. You let people do what they do best. You allow people who know what they're doing to go about their business and not interfere. And that's how it works. And that's how success comes repeatedly.
That's a tremendous definition of what a director does and what a play really is.
Yeah. And it's often taken for granted, and that's usually where you make your mistakes. And I've made my mistakes. I've had plays where things didn't go well, or I've made choices that I've really regretted.
Well, you certainly have it down now, and Paradise Lost is a year to be congratulated. It's a tremendous play. It's an important piece, and it's as good an ensemble piece as you'll see anywhere.
Thank you.
And folks, just make sure you go see the play. And Lou, thanks very much for this interview, and keep up the good work. You're one of those directors, when your name is on a piece, even if it's all typos, you don't know the name of it. Folks, if Lou Conti's directing, go see it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks. And remember, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of September 3rd, 2007. Broadway in Chicago has announced their complete 2008 season series, with The Drowsy Chaperone and Sweeney Todd rounding out the lineup. My Fair Lady opens up the season on January 22nd, being followed by The Drowsy Chaperone opening up on April 1st. Sweeney Todd then comes in on April 23rd, with Avenue Q premiering on May 21st. Closing out the season will be Dirty Dancing, the classic story on stage. The limited engagement, which is the United States premiere, begins on September 2nd. Subscribing to this lineup will also give you the opportunity to priority purchase two of the 2008 off-season specials. The first one will, of course, be the hit The Sparrow by the House Theater. That show starts on September 26th of this year at the Apollo Theater. You will also have the opportunity to priority purchase Rent coming in February 12th. For more information on the Broadway in Chicago complete 2008 season series, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's news section. Get ready, Chicago. The Color Purple will be discounting the remaining tickets for their weeknight shows. This is, of course, including the Wednesday matinees, Wednesday night, Thursday night, and Sunday night shows, with the price coming down to $39.50. This will be the price for the tickets until the end of the show's run on September 30th, so this is your chance to see The Color Purple here in Chicago before it heads west. For more information on how you can get tickets, head on over to our site's Now Playing section. And here's just a little reminder for you, Chicago, that the Tony Award-winning comedy The Producers, starring Ross Lehman as Max and Guy Adkins as Leo, will be starting previews this Wednesday, September 5th at the Marriott Theater in Lincolnshire. Tickets are still available, so get your tickets today. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from King Lear, Act 5, Scene 3. The gods are just. This is the time where I remind you, Chicago, that we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, that theater is happening. Don't miss it. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Lou Conti for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode, ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, Chicago. Keep talking theater.